Independence Day, all that's good. So yeah, I really mm-hmm. like that a lot.
It's a good flow to get into. I mean, you know, when you're sitting there and you're writing a story, there's a lot of things that go on in your mind, you know, putting the pieces together, figuring out, you know, what direction you want to go. Sometimes you can get input from other people if you're sharing that story with them. There is a incredible creative process that comes with writing. You don't really see with other art forms in the exact same way.
Yeah, you may be right. I'm very ignorant in other art forms in the sense that I don't know how to practice them. I can't play music. I can't do other things. But there's a lot involved in writing that's well beyond, well, let's get out the keyboard and start tip-tapping some things in. And in the end, I'll fix the commas and we're good to go. There's a lot more to it than that if you want to produce something of high quality. And, you know, I don't want to speak too highly of myself, but that's what I devote myself to. I try to produce something that I'm proud of. So
that's important because, you know, if you're creating work, which again, some people do this because they have professions or careers and they need income, you know, and they have a really good skill at, for example, journalism or, you know, writing or working for a media company. But for some people, that's not fulfilling enough. You know, they you know, for example, like for yourself, even, you know, arrogant or whatever, it's an important thing you bring out because the thing that makes you the best type of writer to yourself is, how are you successful? Are you successful based on other people's success, or you're based successfully on yourself and what you've worked on and what you've made and what you've spent your career in the past decade or so doing and continue doing? You know what I mean? It's not just a one-step process. It's a many-step process.
It definitely is. And there are the occasional writer out there that do make a living from it and are just really exceptional as well at the quality they produce. But there's a larger portion that it's just typing. It's just very, very low quality writing that has some appeal to certain readerships, and they do well financially, say, but frankly, the writing is no good. It's just some story that continues on that has no sense. For me, the big thing, when I mentioned earlier, I'm not sure if we were recording then, but when I mentioned earlier about literary fiction, what literary fiction focuses on is words and language. So it's not focused on story or things like that, or following the character arc, because that's defined by a certain genre. That's not what literary fiction is about. Literary fiction is about choosing the exact proper words and not worrying too much about the story, not worrying, frankly, whether you even have a story. And that's what I'm interested in. I'm not interested in yarns that someone might tell, or stories that you're waiting for the ending because clues have been laid out and stuff like that.
This is like completely off, but one writer, I love thrillers and psychological horror and things like that nature. And I used, you know, I love Stephen King's books. One of my favorite ones of his books is Pet Sematary. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I love about Pet Sematary is throughout the entire book, which I'm like halfway through, you don't feel over-suspensed, you don't feel questioned, and you don't feel uncomfortable. You seem excited because you kind of, he leaves you like good pointers and good information with each chapter. So you start putting the story together chapter by chapter. But you're right. I hate books like that. I hate books where like, what is that a clue? Is that a hint? Wait a minute. Where is this going? It's, I don't know. There are great psychological thrillers that are like that. I'm not going to lie to you, but It's cheesy. Come on, it's very cheesy.
Yeah, and my experience with it mostly is with One of my other great interests is film, and I watch a lot, and I have difficulty finding really, really great, great films, because a lot of films, and unfortunately I have to say a lot of American films, which are the ones that kind of dominate the market, are really, really embarrassing to watch, because they are done very, very amateurishly or ham-handedly kind of thing. And other films are just kind of fucking blow you away. Just really amazing.
Have you watched Bert Kreischer's The Machina?
I haven't seen that yet. No.
Dude, I'm telling you, for the first time, I think in 11 years, we've got a real comedy film. Like a real comedy film. It's amazing. I don't know who wrote it or who did it. They did a fantastic job.
I like Kreischer. I know, the other thing I like is stand-up comedy, so I know who you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
He's great, yeah. And often he can be dismissed because, that's the guy that takes his shirt off kind of thing. But
Does. He has a tendency of doing that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would if I had a physique like that too, you know. So, no, I'm not making fun of the guy at all.
He's wonderful.
I admire that. That's on my list, Machina. I didn't know about that. Yep.
But, you know, adding to your point, though, that is just a great example of, it's not that they can't make those movies. It's they don't want to. And people, you know, tend to have a hard understanding of like, oh, what is this whole, you know, writer's strike? And there's that part about, you know, the finances and the benefits and so on. There's also the part which a lot of people don't talk about, which exists in the artist community, of control. It's where these writers sit there doing their job, and then this fucking idiot just walks in there, which owns the company, and he's like, I don't like that. That's too sexual. Mm-hmm. You hired the guy to write the story. You're just the marketing executive. What are you doing questioning? I mean, you could talk with him and maybe ask him questions, elaborate on what he's writing, but to like blatantly go out and say, no, you can't do this.
Yeah,
exactly. Doesn't make sense.
What it is it's competing interests, right? Basically, it's, you know, the quality of the aesthetics and the writing itself against the corporation. And the corporation has other interests, like, are we going to get sued? Are we going to lose advertisers? That sort of thing. I'm not defending it, but that's what you basically have, right? So It's sort of like, I don't know if you remember the thing 2 or 3 years ago with a stand-up comedian named Andrew Schultz.
Yeah.
Who was about to put out something. I think it was on Netflix. I don't think he ever really said, but I'm pretty sure it was Netflix. And they wanted him to take out jokes. I think it was some of his abortion jokes. And he refused. And he bought back his own whatever upfront money and ended up getting a sponsor and making a lot more from it than he could. I just rewatched it in the last couple of days, and it's very funny. It's very incorrect, as they would say. It's very unwoke in a lot of ways. But those things are just like the corporate things, those things, just because something is incorrect and unwoke doesn't mean that it's not funny. And
right,
a lot of people don't really get that about comedy. They have other things that compete, so that if you're insulting a certain group that has special pronouns, or if you're insulting or seem to be insulting, and comedians are never insulting. They're basically trying to make people laugh. And literally, as the great Ricky Gervais says, and others say, I don't know if you know a comedian named David Cross as well.
Mm-hmm.
They're not telling the truth up there on the stage. They're doing a show.
Yeah.
And they don't, you know, when the Ricky Gervais says, and he makes a big deal of it, men are smarter than women. No, that's the David Cross one. He doesn't mean that. He just doing, it's a bit, right? It's a show.
Yeah. It's also, you bring up a good point though, because it's also a good thing to keep in mind when you take like George Carlin, which is like one of the most famous comics ever. If you take him seriously in one of his bits, okay, I would question your sanity, because you can clearly tell the guy is just full on raving, like just rave, just full on anger and aggression, but in a way of like, here it is, here's what's going on, and let me tell you.
Right, exactly. But the other thing is, the way I look at it is that it's irrelevant whether he believes it or not. That's not what's relevant. What's relevant is whether it's funny and well done or not. Whether he believes that all people in Congress should be assassinated or something, or that's irrelevant. It doesn't matter whether he believes it or not. It matters whether you laugh at it. And that's the thing. That's always the test.
I think, though, limiting humans' ability for interaction is a problem. And it's an issue that we're dealing with right now, especially with this whole woke movement, this extreme division of scale. There's no balance. There's one side over the other, which is more going to go one way over the other. But then the problem is it starts affecting actual people, such as ourselves, artists, you know, people working in the workforce, and so on. You know, you get to a point where, how far are we willing to go to take this and say, like, man, I just want to enjoy a good book that doesn't have like fucking black lines all over the fucking pages. I want to enjoy a comedy show where he talks about how ladies' tits and ass are way too big for her to hold them. I like that shit. It's fun. It's a good time. It's a good way to spend time with friends and family or whatever. Why do we have to make everything a political agenda? I don't get it.
It really has to do with what your priorities are. Basically, the whole woke movement, and its campaign against free expression, is basically an initiative where they're valuing certain political viewpoints over free expression. The problem with that is that not only what you mentioned about it affecting artists, basically, but freedom of expression is, I don't want to overemphasize it too much, but it's kind of a pillar of democracy. So you don't want to be fucking around with that. No. That pillar, you don't not want to be chipping at the bottom of that, because it's all going to come down if you do.
Yeah, and I mean, we've kind of seen this already. It's kind of weird on how the attitude of a lot of these large companies, and again, it's the people that are running these companies. In a way, maybe they don't understand or they don't appreciate the fact that if they don't have writers, if they don't have cinematographers, if they don't have videographers, there's no money. There's no business. And like, they can keep on throwing out all of the shitty films that they made in 2023. Let's be honest. We thought 2007 was a bad year for movies. 2023 was even worse. So what does that tell you? I mean, for me, that tells me exactly what you're saying is, the second you start chipping at that pillar, this is what starts to happen.
Yep, exactly. This is what happens. I mean, look at all the, I don't know about 2023, but even back further than that, others I know have an interest in this because of the connection with their youth, but the whole Superman, whatever, superhero things, cartoons, as Martin Scorsese said, that are made into movies, right? And it's kind of embarrassing at some level, I find it. So it's basically a business, but the problem is that not only does it chip away at the quality of the products that the artists make, but I'm talking about, again, I'm going to get super grandiose now, democracy itself, because the other thing that's under siege is our journalists.
Yeah.
Speaking the truth and condemned for, because they're saying something that's against what the legacy media say.
Or the political agenda.
Conspiracy theorists, or any way you can kind of blacklist them at all. That's what they're, and once you start messing around with that, where you just have a received viewpoint that is fed to lazy journalists by the government, that's very dangerous.
It's very dangerous when you get into, for example, I have family in Israel, and the amount of bullshit and lying that has gone on with these, you know, large companies that have all of these journalists making up these stories back and forth, which have been proven to not be true. They got this information from terrorists, might we add. And then you don't even apologize. You don't even correct your mistake. You just put in a little note and you move on, and that's it. End of story. It's so hard for me to understand. Again, I understand that these people have jobs, but it's weird. Your career is journalism. The whole fundamental point of journalism is having your own voice, giving over the information that's in front of you and telling the story, the facts, the whole thing, A to Z. Mm-hmm. So why are you bullshitting? You're not a fantasy writer. You're a journalist.
Exactly. That reminds me of two things. One is that I would disagree with you. I would just add to you in the point also was that in that war, I agree. You can't trust what terrorists say, nor can you trust what the Israeli government says, because at a very high level, they have an interest in that. It's basically lying on both sides. So whatever they say, you can completely discount what's being said. A few things have gotten proven and discounted, that's true. But generally speaking, you can't believe anything that either side says. But it reminds me of a classic. I don't know if they do it anymore. It used to be the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where they get a comedian up, and usually the president was there. When Obama was in power, they were a lot of fun because he's very funny. And at one point, during the George Bush era, during the young George Bush,
Junior.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Junior. Exactly. Appropriately named Junior. Mm-hmm. They got Stephen Colbert up, and they obviously hadn't done their research. This is when Colbert was at his brutalist.
Before and, woke.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, okay. And I remember him, he did it all in a complete irony satire mode. And he said something like, God, it's great to be a journalist. You know, you get to listen directly to what the government says, and then you just type it up. That's awesome. What a great job you have. It was just, he just destroyed journalism then. It was amazing to see. Yeah.
He really predicted the future, didn't he?
Yeah. No, that's a good point. That's a good point. Accidentally, he did. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh God. I mean, it's crazy because, like, you know, we've been talking about this. Like, for example, with your own work, do you feel within the past decade or so that your writing has changed, especially like with how the times have changed, you yourself? Has that like affected you in any way?
A little bit. I don't do that kind of writing, and I don't write for income. I write for interest. But in my podcast, for example, I mm-hmm. just have a podcast called Writing and Editing, which is now, it still exists. It's now hosted by my former co-host. Her name is Jenia De Lima, and still a great podcast, but I'm not involved with it. I was involved and founded it for 2 years. But there were some episodes where I had episodes about wokeness and freedom of expression, because those are very, very important to me. But I didn't feel limited. This is the great thing about podcasting. You can generally say what you want to say. And you know, I'm such a small player in the universe. No one knows or cares in a way, as far as anyone who has any kind of power. So I haven't been affected, really. But I feel for the journalists who are really affected. Like, for example, the main one I think about is a great journalist named Matt Taibbi. Mm-hmm. And he writes for Substack. Also has a podcast and the whole sort of thing, and has been grilled at Congress about certain things. And he's revealed news stories that have never been reported at all in the mainstream media, big things. And these are the people I feel for, because he's basically doing great work out there, but it's not being picked up anywhere. And in effect, he's being not silenced, but ignored, right?
Right.
Because, yeah, it's a sad thing. And there's a couple of journalists like that out there, and a couple of podcasters like that too. Yeah.
I agree with you, and I believe that the thing about success, you know, in and itself, for, you know, your own sake and as a person and as an individual, it comes with a price. You can enter the crossroads and sell your soul to the devil, or you don't have to do that, but then you have to figure out, is it left, is it right, is it straight, or is it the other way? You don't know.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of like what I was talking about earlier about the corporation. If you put that down into the microcosm of the individual, you say, what do I want? Do I want to be completely, truthfully integrative? Or, God damn it, there's temptation of money over here. Or there's a temptation of physical pleasure over here. Or there's a temptation of a promotion back here. What do I really want to do? And that's where your character will speak up. And it would be very telling which direction you take. Sometimes you can have all of them, but sometimes you can't. Sometimes you have to make a choice.
Sometimes you do. And the hard truth, and I think one thing that I've had to come to the realization of, when you're an artist and you're doing something that you're passionate about, yes, you wanted to reach out to an audience, but at the same time, you're also looking for a connection. You know, you like mentioned with podcasting, why do people like podcasts? Because they can be, in a way, a part of a conversation. You know, they can sit in their car after a long day of work and just veg out, you know, and maybe learn something. That one thing that's really cool, like what's his name? He's the Russian. Oh my God, he's a Russian dude. He always wears a Lex Friedman.
Don't know him.
Yeah. He's a podcaster, but he was originally from Russia. I believe his family escaped, and he worked in business and like he was an entrepreneur and so on. But the way he has conversations, he's had conversations with like Kanye West, you know, and very interesting figures. And when he talks with them, and as you get through the conversation, and it kind of gets like deeper and deeper and deeper, you realize that he's not interviewing the other person.
Mm-hmm.
They're interviewing him.
Mm-hmm.
I love that, you know, like that strategy. It's amazing.
Yeah, no, it's true. That's a pretty admirable mode there. The other one in between is kind of what you do and is what I used to try to do as well. And it's a kind of a cliche to say it now, but to turn things into a conversation and not an interview. And the worst podcaster, well, unless you're an interview podcast, but if you're one where you want to sort of engage the readers, the listeners more, it seems like just people are chatting. But I tried very hard when I did probably, I don't know, 100, 125 interviews when I did the 2 years of my podcast. And I tried very hard for, even though I had notes in front of me in one corner, little bullet points, I tried very hard to keep it conversational. One of the secrets there, boys and girls, get out your pens and copy this down, is listen to what the other person is saying, believe that or believe it or not. Listen to what they're saying and be willing to go off the bullets that you have set to say. And if they say something that's intriguing, dive deep into it or query them on it, you know?
Right.
That's where it comes from. The same thing, frankly, applies in any kind of conversation. A coffee that you're having with a friend or a date. And I've had this experience as well. People do not ask questions. People don't, they sort of, they treat it as a, Let me see if I come up with a quick analogy. I know one part of the analogy, they treat it as a tennis match where I hit the ball, you hit the ball. I hit the ball, you hit the ball. I hit the ball, you hit the ball. So there's no, so I would, if I would keep the sports analogy, maybe it would be more like rugby or a football tackle kind of thing where you get in there and really get around with it. That's what it should be like. And, right. But I really wish people asked questions in all modes. And I guess I would end off by saying that the reason I think, or one of the reasons people don't ask questions, is that at a fundamental level, they're not curious. They're not curious about what makes other people tick, as they say.
There's also a level of fear, because there is this sense of feeling when you're approaching someone, especially a stranger or someone that you're not familiar with, or someone that has different views than you do. And you run into the issue of not asking those questions because you're afraid of what their response is going to be. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be a negative, you know, it could be a positive, but you don't know. So sometimes that fear in it itself can cause you not to be able to push forward in that conversation.
I see what you're saying. I believe you have, not you, but one has to surmount that fear and just go for it. What's the worst that can happen, right?
Right.
And in a one-on-one conversation at the coffee shop, as I was saying, often also the fear has to do with being perceived as being nosy or asking personal questions or anything like that.
Define a personal, I love that. Define a personal question. You know, you always hear that, right? That's a personal question. What does that exactly mean? You know?
Well, for example, if you're at a, let's say it's a first date at a coffee shop where you're expected to sort of try to get a feel for each other and see how things go. A personal question, a non-personal question has to do with, I don't know, the kinds of TV shows you like, the weather, of course, boy, this coffee is good, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. A personal question, and I tell people this, I would be, rather than make small talk during a first date interview or at a party, I would prefer that people ask me about the traumas from my youth that have affected me. I want to talk about the gut-wrenching stuff that makes me who I am.
Oh, and Jesus.
I'd be willing to tell them straight out about it, or about my insecurities, or about any kind of deep thing like that that really says is about you as a person. You know, or ask me about my writing process, or ask me about what are things that you're really passionate about? That sorts of thing. I don't want to talk with the goddamn weather and stuff like that. That's what I mean by a personal question, something that's really intrusive.
Right.
A really great person will pick up on it. And if you ask them, and they will just go and answer the question. A really person who's not used to that thing will maybe say something or just get all nervous and say, well, I guess I'll never have a second date with this guy, that kind of thing. So that's what I mean by a personal question.
Right. No, and I really, that's actually a really great explanation. You really elaborated really well on that. And you do bring up a good point, that thought in your head of, okay, he asked these questions, so I don't think there's going to be a second date. That's interesting, because as a person, when you're dating somebody or you're, you know, relationship wise or whatever, if that's what's going on in that person's head, are they relationship material? Like, are they going to be a person that you can have fluid communication and be open with, you know, and build something with, or you're going to have a really shitty 12 years?
Yeah. And actually, I've often come to the conclusion of I've been on a dating site or various ones for about a year now. And so I've been on 10 or 12 pretty horrific dates. And usually it's me who concludes because I don't get asked any questions. And when I ask personal questions, people are very awkward about answering them. And yeah, my conclusion is this won't be good. And I'm not talking about women. I'm not saying anything about women in general. I'm talking about the unsuitable ones for me in what I want, which is direct communication. What I would give people is that, yeah, okay, maybe it's a bit heavy to hear this on a first date.
Right.
Come on, you know, what's to be lost by giving it all up? I really had a kind of a change in the last, I don't know, 5-6 years or so where I thought, I don't care anymore. In the sense of I care a lot about just tell your truth, you know, just say it. It's not going to hurt. It's good. And especially if it's someone you want to have sex with or want to have a relationship with,
right.
Give it up. It's great. You know, life is short.
You're right. And I try to have that attitude of being an open book. I'm the type of person, you know, for example, I date men. And in that scenario, you know, you deal with a lot of different things. You deal with types of men that are very closed. They won't open themselves up at all. You know, you meet guys that are extremely feminine. For me personally, that's not something that I'm looking for. And that just goes the completely opposite way. And that's the thing, though, you're right, where when I meet somebody, you know, texting is great, but I actually, for me, is I want to meet the person. Mm-hmm. When I meet the person, I want to see what their personality is, you know, how comfortable they are in a conversation. And if they're not, then, you know, like we were saying, is you have to then ask yourself the question of, okay, if you're going to be in a relationship with this person, you don't have to move too far in the future. I'm not telling you to like plan your marriage, you know, and how many kids and how many dogs and you're living in the fucking suburbs. But more of where do you see yourself being in a relationship with this person sexually, you know, romantically, affectionately, all of that combined? And if you question that, I don't think there should be a second date. Maybe.
Yeah, right. It's interesting that you should say that because it's curious about your focus, if I'm hearing you right, is about conversation and connection. And you're trying to perceive that on a first date. And you were mentioning certain types that you like and everything, but that seems to be the thing. And I think for a lot of people, if I'm inferring correctly, that's not so important. Like conversation is not so important, and connection and saying things and being open. Maybe it only has to do with they just don't want to do it on a first date. I don't know what it's like in dating men. I date women.
It's very similar to dating women. I'm not going to lie to you.
I've heard that some of the parts are different. That's just what I've heard.
Yeah,
in media.
Some of the parts are different, but mentality and physicality wise, it's a lot like women.
Very funny. But you know, it may be that they might be fine 5 dates along, but often what you'll hear or what is expressed is that I want to get to know you first. And usually that means about finding out facts about you. And it often means also, I don't want to have sex with you until I get to know you. And I never got the chance to say this, but the way I see it is that, can we do this earlier? I don't just mean the sex. I mean, can we not like get real down and dirty, conversationally dirtier sooner? And sex is a way of getting to know someone as well. So can we not start that earlier as well? Believe me, at 64, I'm not a sexual animal. I'm not the guy I was when I was in my 30s. So it's not as if I want to go at it all the time. I couldn't manage it without some severe scaffolding kind of thing. So all I mean is that it's not this thing where I consider a very upper middle classy thing where, well, I'll get to know the person And then after a course of 2 months, when we've established that we are okay for each other, then perhaps some intimate sexual encounters would be appropriate. I don't see it that way at all. I see it as sort of you start the race car right. It's like a drag race rather than a slow country ride kind of thing. You just go. That's the way.
Yeah, it's like either, you know, Chrysler Town and Country or Dodge Demon, you know, Hellcat or a Hellcat. I'm going to choose the Challenger.
I just, you know, I've been watching, I watch Google Shorts instead of, I don't want to be on TikTok. So I watch Google Shorts, which is this kind of the equivalent. And somehow, I don't know how, what logarithm gives it to me, but I get videos of this guy in a white Nissan GTR, which I believe has over 500 horsepower. Mm-hmm. And often he gets challenged by guys on motorcycles, which of course can go super fast. And he almost always just blows them away. And there's this great camera mount where they kind of like this. And then they decide, and he is gone. And then he has a back camera looking at the motorcycles about like half a mile behind him. Awesome to see.
Bro, I just imagine that, you know, in the bedroom. Oh, boy. Who's the motorcycle and who's the GTR?
I wasn't thinking of that, but since
I have to put those things together sometimes. this is part of the process. But I do see your point, and you're right. A lot of the times, you know, this whole, you know, waiting and kind of figuring things along the way, It can definitely be an issue. It's actually funny talking about this. One TV show that I really like, it's called Sex and the City.
Yep.
And in Sex and the City, Charlotte, which is one of the characters, she actually waits. So she meets this guy, she loves the guy, and she waits. And everybody is like, why don't you? So she waits. Sure enough, he's sex incompetent.
Oh.
Yeah. So then you're dealing the rest of the season of her going out of her mind because she's in this relationship and she loves this guy, but she can't procreate, like, nothing. And she's just miserable. Like, she's just having, and it just, in a way, I know it's a TV show, but it just kind of just goes to show you a little bit that maybe when you're making a big commitment, such as a relationship, that I think that the brakes should not be pressed as much at the beginning. Because, yeah, like, you're right. It's good to get to know the person, you know, get to know all the nitty gritty, you know? Like, who did you fuck like 2 years ago? Okay, I'm writing this down. All right. They have AIDS? No. You sure? Herpes. Super gonorrhea? No. Okay. You're sure? All right. These are things you need to know.
That was, by the way, once considered to be a superhero that they declined at Disney, super gonorrhea, and they considered it for a while and thought, no, that's not our audience. I'm kidding.
Actually, with Disney in its current state, I wouldn't put it past them.
Super gonorrhea.
I mean, they've already gotten into children's lives about sexuality and all sorts of things. Next thing they know, they'll be like, hey, kids. Ever heard of STDs? We're going to learn about them.
But just to get back to what you were saying, it's a really good point about knowing everything. And also, my experience anyway in having sex with people is that with men, is that with men, with women. Wow.
Poor men. It's okay.
I've come out here right on this. Is that having sex really... I don't want to get too wishy-washy and sentimental about it, but you get to know a part of a person that, you know, a figurative part of a person that you don't know without having sex with them. And this is all part of the process of getting to know them kind of thing, you know? So that's how I feel about it.
Yeah, For sure. And, you know, it's really cool because I like this because you're a writer and you're a creative thinker. I mean, I'm assuming, but you seem that type of person talking with you. And getting into this idea where there's always an attitude of what to do and how to do it in every situation. You know, we have a name for the dates. There's the first date, you know, there's the second date, and there's the third date. And then there's the meeting someone, you know, and then there's the part of the first time. We have names for all of these things. And in a way, it kind of feels a little bit planned, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, I would see two offenders that have caused this in our society. One is, you know, the whole middle class scheme of, yeah, it's all leading to marriage, so we need certain markers along the way. And the other one, of course, the big offender in many of the bad things in our culture is religion. And I think see that as the as another of the causes, certainly for the sexual hesitation, right? I see that as another one of the huge influences in our society where sexuality is often demonized by, well, I don't know about other religions. I know about Christianity, and definitely it's often demonized in Christianity as something that you can't do until you're married, for example.
Yeah, it's very, I'm Jewish, so, and I was raised Orthodox. It's similar in a way, what you're saying, where, you know, you can't have any kind of sexual encounters or anything until after marriage. It also depends, because depending on, you know, what type of Orthodoxy, you know, if you're modern Orthodox or, but this is the thing, like, you know, you brought this up about religion. It just gets into these holes in the Swiss cheese, and it goes all different ways, and I don't see why this has to be complicated. I mean, for Christ's sakes, we've been around for over 200 million years as a species, okay? We've been wiped out twice. I mean, one is Apophis, which is the Younger Dryas theory, and then there's the other one, which was over 100 million years ago. But hello, we figured out how to fuck our way to 2024, baby.
And we've got another, I'm happy to say, 2 or 3 years left before we're eliminated again. Yay. So let's get it on, you know. Yeah, so.
But it's a good point, and it's a true factor of our existence. It's where a lot of the times we feel like, even as an artist, I feel a lot of the times things are planned. You know, there's this idea of being a successful artist, you know, being a famous artist, you know, being able to like accomplish and have like the biggest platform. But is that really what you're going after, or what you're trying to go after is making the best thing that you can make? You know, the best, like, for example, writing, you know, the best story that you can come up with. I mean, because isn't that what you're, again, like, trying to represent other people? I don't know why this is so complicated. It's like fans. Okay, what about your work?
Right. Yeah, no, you always have to, I totally with you there. You always have to keep in mind, like, why exactly am I doing this? And if you're doing it for money and stuff, or fans or whatever, and it's easy to do that even with podcasting, where you're doing it for downloads and things like that. You know, I can say with some confidence that I never approach Joe Rogan levels on downloads with my podcast. But I thought it was, I tried to keep it a very high quality, and I got some good reviews of it. But it was very much, you know, maybe it's the $10 million per year that I wasn't getting. I'm not sure. But to be serious about your point, yeah, you have to be always cognizant of the whole purpose of it. And just to go back, that applies to podcasting, certainly applies when you're writing fiction. If you want, you have to be massaging that and editing that and going over that and deleting bits and all that. It's a whole process, and you have to be satisfied with the end product. I recently did a project where I went through and looked at my past writings, and there were, I think, two or three novels that I was no longer proud of. And I was lucky enough to get Amazon to remove them from Amazon, which apparently they rarely do. So now I only have up on online the four books that I'm proud to be affiliated with. And the other two or three that were embarrassing, no longer, it's as if they never existed. So I'm happy about that.
Poof. And they're gone.
Exactly.
Gone. To what you were saying, though, when, like, even like with Joe Rogan, it's just a luck of the cards, you know, and it's this idea of becoming, you know, like a content creator, like that is your career. That is how you're going to be successful. Try to understand that a lot of these people, like Joe Rogan right now has only been successful. Just put this in perspective. 13 years, maybe 20. And the man is like 56, and he started like back in 89. So he was unsuccessful. He was semi-successful for about like 25 to 26 years of his life. So most of his like adulthood, he was like, Dave Chappelle is another great example of this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you know how many years he was an unsuccessful comic? Years.
Yeah.
So no one talks about this. It's like, well, I want to reach that. Do you understand like what it took to get there? Just try to understand that for a second.
Yeah. With stand-up comedians, for example, two things I would say. One is that a lot of the great stand-ups play a lot of shitty clubs in a lot of shitty cities and stay in a lot of shitty motels. And that's how they kind of hone their craft, if I can use a kind of a fruity phrase like that. But that's how they do it. And the other thing is that a lot of the sort of the opposite of that or whatever is that a lot of the stand-up comedians that are very successful now, with some notable exceptions, are ones that are, I don't know, you know, the exceptions I want to hurry to say are Ricky Gervais, who deserves everything because he is genuinely unfettered and funny. And Chris Rock is also in that category of someone who,
and Kevin Hart. Oh my God. I love Kevin. Kevin Hart is so fucking funny.
Yeah. I don't know him so well, but I saw him do the roast of Justin Bieber. He was awesome on that. Awesome. 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 About that. Yeah. He was great.
Comics.
Yeah. And he did great. He was the host, of course, and people don't understand roast. He was a guy, not so much who came up and did like 7 minutes about Bieber, but he was basically introducing all the roasters and having something to say about all of them. And he was great. And he had the right attitude, too, because when he's probably just over 5 feet high or something, but also Shaquille O'Neal is on the show, who apparently is about 10 foot six. And they did a part once where Shaquille grabbed them and spanked them on the ass and stuff like a little baby. And it was fascinating.
Oh my God.
But it was great because Hart had the right attitude about it. There was one joke, for example, where someone said, God, Kevin, what's it like to go up on your wife? And he just laughed and laughed and laughed, which is the correct attitude. So.
But he did. If I'm not mistaken, I think he did speak about and how he was bullied.
Yeah.
And You know, that's the thing that I like. You can see even like with Chris Rock as another great example. He has been hit back and forth from famous celebrities to large corporations and companies, and he has come through thick and thin for the past 23 years, which is incredible. It just, again, like we were been talking about, it just goes to show you these are artists that they love being artists. They love being creative. They love being on stage. Yes, they care about their fans, but mostly what they're doing is for themselves.
Yeah. You'll often hear that a lot of these during their childhood, for example, they would do things like, you know, they would memorize the Tonight Show or something like that, or they would be in their basement with a little recorder pretending to do interviews and things like that. Just, you know, maybe total nerds at the time, but just in love with the whole idea of it. And
I'm not old enough to remember this, but there was a time where like the Tonight Show, you know, with two different genres. He would bring on new comics.
Yes.
So people that were, you know, just around the crowd, and then their career would just.
That's right.
And times have changed because now you don't need that anymore.
No. Yes. And the opposite is true too. You don't need that anymore because there are many venues where you can come to the fore, TikTok or your own special, or like Andrew Schultz. I think his career after that one stand-up special has no one had heard of him before. I'd never heard of him. Not to say that I'm the be-all and the end-all of knowing, but the other thing is that there's no like one show where, boy, if we could only make it on Kimmel, we're all set. There's no show like that now, right? So
I mean, you have to be real, like nothing against Kimmel, but his ratings compared to some of these comics or some podcasters that comedians will go on is so much higher. So yeah. As a comic, it might make more sense to go on Theo Von's podcast than to go on to the Jimmy Kimmel Show.
Just, right.
Yeah. Think about that for a sec. It's crazy.
Yeah. Because you're in the right niche, even though, for example, Kimmel is a comedian and has comedians on. He's basically a talk show host. So he will have on lots of people who have nothing to do with comedy. I don't know. I've seen little bits of Theo Von's show, but I've seen little bits of others as well. Kreischer and what's his name? The other great, great guy. Have a show together, two bears and a cup or something it's called.
Something like that. Yeah.
And, but what I was going to say is that their niche is comedy, whereas Kimmel is more of a generalist, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it just kind of shows a little bit of, you know, the shift of perspective. It's where as an artist, where do you want to put yourself in? Because, you know, collaboration is really important. Communication, being able to open up and talk about what you're doing and the work that you're doing is really important. But when you have these platforms that they have their own agenda, they're not there to help build your career or any shape or form. But now there is that option of podcasters that are comedians that, unlike Jimmy Kimmel, actually are on the road. They actually perform live on stage in front of audiences. You have the opportunity to talk with this type of person and be able to reach their audience, which more than likely will listen to your show. They'll probably, you're in their area, they probably will book a ticket if they, oh, wow, they're on Theo Von. I want to check this out. I want to go. That is more realistic for you as an artist compared to being a part of that corporate, you know, network.
Yeah, no, that's right. Exactly. You know, broadcast television kind of thing or whatever it's called now. Well, I hear it called legacy media. So it's a good point that you make. Exactly. Right.
Mind me asking, You mentioned about your books. You mentioned you were a part of a podcast. To anybody that is listening, where exactly can they find your work and what type of work have you made?
Everything is, my name is Wayne Jones, and if you go to waynejones.ca, I'm in Canada, it has links to everything I've done. So basically what I've done is that I used to write short stories. I don't do that anymore. I published one novel that I'm still very pleased with called The Killing Type. It's a simultaneously a mystery novel and a parody of mystery novels. I'm still happy with that book. I've written a
novel. I like the title.
That's right. Thanks. And I've written a book, I guess you would call it a memoir, about personal minimalism called Less and Less. It's a very teeny book, about 75 pages long, but I'm still happy with that book as well. Basically looking at the psychology of someone who likes minimalism in their personal space and what that says for their relationships with people. So I tried to be honest and self-examine in that way. And then I've written two biographies. One was just published a few months ago called My Sam Johnson. And this is a biography of someone I studied in university, a writer who lived in the 1700s in England. But then I've also co-written with a great comedian named Matt Ballacher, who's based in California, a biography of the great, the awesome, the superb stand-up comedian, Greg Giraldo. We co-wrote that biography. And those are the books that I've done. And my podcast, I was retired and I like talking and I like expressing myself. And I know a little bit about writing and I know a little bit about editing. I also do freelance editing. And I thought I'll start a podcast, and I was happy to see it grow. Over 2 years, it grew a lot, you know, in my scale kind of thing. And eventually, though, I got a little tired of doing it. And fortunately, I found this great person, friend, to take it over, and she's now doing it, and we'll make it, I'm sure we'll make it even better. So that was called Writing and Editing. It's still going. You can get it, as they say, wherever you get your podcasts. And it's a really great thing. And now what I'm going to start is I'm just preparing it. You can also, I discovered podcast via Substack. So I'm going to do a Substack newsletter, but also a podcast, and this will be a scripted podcast, unlike the other ones, which were mostly were all unscripted, called An Introduction to Christianity, and it's basically done as a satire. So
I gotcha.
It's all about establishing the right tone, and that's going to debut probably in a couple of weeks. I'm just sort of planning it now. The style of it and everything.
Letting it brew, you know?
That's true. And okay. Just testing out the technology and all that sort of thing. And the two denominations I'm very familiar with are Pentecostalism and Roman Catholicism. But I know a fair bit about Christianity generally. And I want to talk about that. And I also read lots of the Bible, the Christian Bible. And so I want to play around with that and make fun of it and satirize it and that kind of thing. So An Introduction to Christ. I like the title, I have to say, because it doesn't sound like what you're going to get. It sounds like, oh, wow, I might be interested in reading about Christianity.
I said this before and I'll say this again. It's interesting on how we as humans can understand that 6,000 years ago was a long time ago, but at the same time accept faith and religion that was followed by people that lived 6,000 years ago. It's just, okay, cool. Yeah, enjoy.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my God. Well, I love that. You seem like the type of writer that offers interesting, enticing, not only stories, but a bit of parody and comedy, which I like. It's always good to have a little bit of comedy in there.
Comedy, life is not worth it without it. So
no, yeah. Laughter is always key. Do you have any like socials or anything that people can follow you?
I don't. I actually have been very consciously limiting that. I have a social on Instagram for the book that I published, the biography, and that's at my Sam Johnson. That's the only social I have. I've been very consciously trying to limit those. So, yep.
Smart. Yeah, I 100% agree with you. I try to keep things very limited too, like to the point where I if I post something, it's about the podcast, plain and simple.
Good. Excellent.
You have to keep it to the point. Well, listen, Wayne, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being on the podcast and coming all the way from Canada. And if you want to listen more and find out about the podcast, you can find us on Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube at Lost in the Groove Pod. So with that, we'll catch you on the next one. All right. Bye, everybody. All about the artist. That is the whole purpose of this podcast, period. And you have a really valuable tool. You can share this with artists, people that are creative, someone that can enjoy this podcast and really enjoy the experience of Lost in the Groove. So with that, let's jump back to today's episode, shall we? Hey, it's Dave, and I quickly just wanted to jump in and say, if you've been enjoying the podcast and enjoying this episode, if you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, that'll be so greatly appreciated. Because here's the thing, someone might read that review and make the choice if they want to listen to the podcast. You get to help grow this podcast with us. How fucking cool is that? Let's jump back to today's episode.